The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Trump's administration sure admires a certain nation, and this adulation makes me terribly scared. There is no refuting how the Russians are recruiting Trump to work for Putin. Be forewarned and prepared. So before we get distracted by this weird bromance, let's examine how they do the Trump and Putin dance. Since his pal Vlad stroked his ego, Trump's enthralled by his new amigo. Look how he's attacked, claims the Russians hacked. Things like basic facts leave him cold. When they say Russians have dirt on ya, he just tells the press, das vidanya. As we try to sort through that spy report and learn that even Trump's showers are gold. He won't let us see his tax returns, which would show how much he owes Russia. I don't know why we can't find a competent 12-year-old kid to hack them. And if this tune sounds familiar, I bet you thought it's the song from Tetris. But if Trump keeps this up, pretty soon it'll be our national anthem. So let's say nyet to Russia and say we know they interfered. Though Trump admires Putin's attributes, like the world's best prostitutes, which itself is a hoot. Their denials are so angry that it seems they doth protest a bit too much. Trump would like us to be clueless, even as he's sinking into Putin's clutch. Says to us and our resistance, ooh, we're just getting started, you bet. And we will stand up to and oppose both those gold-plated schmoes. Tell Trump and Putin yet.
Lauren Mayer. Oh, she keeps knocking him out of the park. Yes, Lauren Mayer is her name. You can find her on Facebook, on YouTube. I'll put a link up today to on my blog where I post the podcast of the show to her page, so you can find some of her other stuff. I like to try to start the show off these days with a bit of humor because we need to take the laughs where we can get them. I was running late today. I was a bit discombobulated. It is pouring here in South Florida, and right now Jackson is calm. I gave him. We have this rescue remedy stuff for dogs that calms him down. He freaks out when there's thunder and lightning. And it's been every afternoon here in Florida. You know, the storms are the summer storms are coming. But it's not as bad as what I've seen on the TV with flooding, flash floods everywhere, fires. And this is the new normal. This is climate change, people. These storms, these 100-year storms that are now happening every year. You know, this is the new normal. Get used to it. Ugh. There's a lot going on today. Today, let me tell you who our guest is. It's the author of a book, and actually by listener suggestion, the author's name is David Ferris, and his book is It's Time to Fight Dirty: How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. We need to know that. And then we also need to know how to fix the Democratic Party, because, yes, I know the Democratic Party is broken. However, it's going to be decades, if ever, before a third party can come into being and unseat one of these two major parties. The only way to rid ourselves of this Republican Party is to vote in the Democrats. And I know a lot of people listening have a problem with the Democrats, but the only way to get rid of the Republicans is to vote in the Democrats. Then you work from the inside to fix the Democrats. You elect as many real progressives as possible, and you change the party from the bottom up. It's the only way to do it. And then go ahead and work on outside things. But if we have any hope for the immediate future, if we have any hope to get past January, the Democrats need to ideally take back both the House and the Senate. But at least one of them. If they don't take back one of them. Oh, Jackson, no, honey. My poor dog just peed. Okay. He never, ever pees in the house, and he just peed. Oh, well, I think it's the thunder that's freaking him out. Oh, Jackson, lie down, Bubba. Go on. All right. Well, nothing I can do about that now. I guess I've got to clean that up afterwards. I'll tell you what. There's a lot going on. Let's just start with the news, shall we?
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, here's the big news that Trump, I think, telescoped yesterday. The U.S. economy expanded at a 4.1% rate in the April to June quarter, the highest level in nearly 4 years and Trump's best showing yet. The GDP was the strongest since the third quarter of 2014 when growth hit 5.2%. Yes, that was during the Obama years. And Obama had four other quarters that were higher than Trump's 4.1, just in case you were wondering. Trump is taking a victory lap. But, and this is the important part, most independent economists say this quarter's growth was juiced by stimulus from the $1 trillion tax cut and a one-time rush by foreign companies to stock up on U.S. goods before Trump's trade war escalated and tariffs kicked in on many products. Consumer spending was also solid. But the widespread expectation is that growth will be significantly lower in the third and fourth quarters, likely falling short of Trump's 3% goal for the year. So don't be fooled. You know, arm yourself. Let me share a little bit of this. It's a Washington Post article. Trump cheers amazing economic growth as economists caution it could be a blip. It's a blip, people. Let me see if I can find it. The bottom line takeaway is that this growth is not sustainable and it will slow in the second half of the year, said Laksham Achuthan, co-founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute. Trump should celebrate this number because it is going to ease from here. The federal government will release its initial estimate of third quarter growth on October 26th. That's just 11 days before Election Day, making it a key test of whether high growth appears to be sustainable and is being felt across the country. Greg Valerie, chief global strategist at Horizon Investment, said Trump has to be careful not to overhype this. There are still areas of the country that have not fully come back, and that's Trump's constituency. Wage growth has been anemic. So, again, this is a temporary blip. And just in case some of your, you know, right wing relatives start bragging, let's see the Trump economy. Not so fast. Seriously, not so fast. In other news. Yes, there's a lot more going on. Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, reportedly claims the president knew in advance about that infamous 2016 Trump Tower meeting in which Russians had promised his campaign dirt about Hillary Clinton. Jim Sciutto and Carl Bernstein broke the story last night on CNN.
Sources with knowledge tell myself and Carl that Michael Cohen claims that then-candidate Donald Trump knew in advance about the June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower in which Russians were expected to offer his campaign dirt on Hillary Clinton. Crucially, these sources tell us that Cohen is willing to make that assertion to the special counsel Robert Mueller. Cohen alleges as well that he was present, along with several others, when Trump was informed of the Russians' offer he was informed by Donald Trump Jr. About that offer. By Cohen's account, Trump approved going ahead with that meeting with the Russians. Now, we should note that our sources said Cohen does not have evidence such as audio recordings to corroborate his claim. A source familiar with Cohen's House testimony said he did not testify that Trump had advanced knowledge. Cohen's claims were not mentioned as well in separate reports issued by both Republicans and Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee.
Now, Cohen's legal team insists they did not leak this revelation, raising the possibility it came from the Trump team to weaken Cohen's bargaining hand should he decide to flip and speak to special counsel Robert Mueller. Rudy Giuliani was on Chris Cuomo's CNN show last night, right after the story broke. He spent most of the time discrediting Michael Cohen, painting him as a liar who is not to be believed. And I'm watching this thing. I watched it in real time. And I have a small clip here. Let me just play this. This is Giuliani smearing Michael Cohen.
There's no doubt in my mind that he's just not credible. I would not accept him as a witness, as a prosecutor. If Mueller has any other kind of case, this is the kind of witness that can really destroy your whole case, because any finder of fact loses confidence in the case when you rely on a guy like this, when you rely on a guy where before you finish with him, you're going to have such a string of lies. You just can't trust him. And you put him under this kind of pressure. And what's his history been? His history has been lying under pressure.
Talk about lying. Has he heard his client? Donald Trump is the biggest liar to ever hold public office. Many news organizations are keeping track of Trump's lies, from the Washington Post to the New York Times and others. Back in May, the Post said Trump hit the milestone of 3,000 untrue or misleading statements in 466 days in office, calculating that on average each day, Trump says 6.5 things that aren't true every single day. And I believe that number has risen since. Take some mighty big balls for Donald Trump's representative to call someone else out for lying. And if I had, you know, yes, Giuliani calling someone else a liar, which is just ridiculous. And that was just one little section. There was one part where he went off and on about how Michael Cohen is just a liar. And all I could think is, listen to who's talking. And if I had, you know, a stronger stomach, I would have edited more of it for you, but you get the idea. Meanwhile, Trump's longtime financial gatekeeper, Alan Weisselberg, has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury in the criminal probe of former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. More from MSNBC. Is this the right one? Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal reports that Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer and executive vice president of the Trump Organization, was subpoenaed by the Southern District of New York in the Michael Cohen investigation. Sources familiar with the probe told the Journal Weisselberg is considered a witness. Last year, Weisselberg arranged for the Trump Organization to pay Cohen after he'd made a $130,000 payment to Stephanie Clifford, known as Stormy Daniels, to keep quiet about an alleged affair. One of the president's closest and oldest business associates, Weisselberg has worked with Trump since the 1980s and even was featured on The Apprentice. Just days before Trump was inaugurated, he turned over his business operations to his two grown sons under Weisselberg's guidance. Neither he nor the Trump Organization responded to the Journal's request for comment.
Of course not. You know, right about now, Donald Trump is, I guess, heading up a meeting of the cybersecurity unit, you know, to deal with elections. This after they just last week cut funding to zero for cybersecurity for elections in Congress. The Republicans did that. So while all this is going on and nothing will be done, there is nobody in charge of, by the way, cybersecurity at the White House. There is nobody there. The Daily Beast, though, is reporting that Senator Claire McCaskill has been targeted for cyber attacks by Russia.
Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, first identified candidate now to be targeted by Russian hackers ahead of the midterm
elections.
And they
don't elections. Know what they're getting into.
The Daily Beast was the first to link McCaskill to phishing attempts to infiltrate her campaign through staff's email passwords. Around the time of the hack attempt, President Trump was in Missouri chastising McCaskill and asking the crowd to vote her out of office. We first learned of Russia's midterm hacking attempts last week during a security forum.
Earlier this year, we did discover that a fake Microsoft domain had been established as the landing page for phishing attacks, and we saw metadata that suggested those phishing attacks were being directed at three candidates who were all standing for election in the midterm elections. I can tell you that they were all people who because of their positions, might have been interesting targets from an espionage standpoint as well as an election disruption standpoint.
Senator McCaskill has been highly critical of Russia and is a top Senate Democrat facing tough re-election this year. She issued a statement saying the cyber attack was unsuccessful and, quote, it is outrageous that they think they can get away with this. I will not be intimidated.
Well, let's hope not. Claire McCaskill, not my favorite senator, but she's better than the alternative. See, this is what I'm talking about. Next week, we're going to speak with a guy who's heading up a new group called the Movement Voter Project. And I'll wait until next Friday and let him really explain to you what it's about. But it's a way to get money to the organizations who are helping grassroots groups in local communities get out the vote. It's for, you know, in places like Indiana, where you may not want to give money to Joe Donnelly, you know, because he's Joe Donnelly, but you want him to win re-election because he'll be better than the Republican who would take his place. Plus, the Democrats need the seat to take control of the Senate. So this group helps get money to these grassroots groups. It's a big picture kind of thing. So we'll do that next week. The remains of 55 American servicemen killed during the Korean War have been released by North Korea and flown to a U.S. airbase. So there's that. It's a start. One day after the White House banned a CNN reporter from attending an open press event, Fox News host Shepard Smith launched a strong defense of journalists aimed at Trump's base. I don't understand why Shepard Smith stays at Fox, but I guess it's a good thing. At least they've got somebody with principles on the air there.
For those of you at home, if I may, journalists are not the enemies of the people. It's quite the opposite. Our profession is enshrined in the Constitution, and the Fourth Estate holds the essential job of being your eyes and often ears, and when appropriate, your voice. It's a cornerstone of our republic. Over 22 years at this network, it has been my experience that the journalists of Fox News and Fox Business, and those of our colleagues at competitors at CNN and MSNBC, NBC, ABC and CBS, Bloomberg and PBS, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, The New York Times, The Washington Post, all of them operate in the public interest. We work to discern what is truth, then to present it to you in context and with perspective, and as your representatives in the people's halls report to you without fear or favor, while striving to hold those in power to the same standards. This is the foundation of what we do. It's our reason for being, our purpose. Please know this. I acknowledge many thousands of your complaints and protestations, and in doing so, I offer this. Never have I personally misrepresented the truth to you. Our reports are checked, rechecked, and approved at the editorial management level of this network. And in the event I make a mistake, I tell you and correct it in a timely and appropriate manner. As an aside, when the president attacks journalists, we question his motivation and try to discover the underlying reason. For historically, those who regularly and as a matter of pattern attack the messenger, who degrade and belittle the purveyors of truth, and work to diminish the free press, often find the facts displeasing and endeavor to keep you from knowing them. We are on guard, and we hope, politics aside, for the greater good, that you are too.
Good for him. You know, and it needed to be said, and it needs to keep being said, because we have a president who keeps exclaiming that the free press is the enemy of the people. No, a lying, scheming, authoritarian, strongman wannabe president is the enemy of the people. Somebody who lies to you with every utterance that comes out of his mouth, that's the enemy of the people. And the more people listen to this guy, the more dangerous it becomes. You know, I have that... I put together last year, shortly after Trump took office, a little production piece based on the 14 characteristics of fascism. And I think I'm going to have to trot that out one day next week. It's like a 20-minute piece, so I don't have time to get to it today. But I think I need to air that every few weeks as a reminder of what we're facing, because this is dangerous stuff. Calling the press the enemy of the people is one of the most chilling things out there. The press is enshrined in the Constitution. The filibuster isn't, you know, the Senate isn't. And we're going to talk about changes that we need to make. But you're right. As Cynthia said in the chat room, Trump is the enemy of the people. And we need to call them out. Look, I've been critical of the press, of the media. Some of them, you know, MSNBC comes to mind, trying so hard to, you know, play it down the middle and be fair to both sides. They have an overabundance of Republicans on the air. Granted, they're mostly Republicans who think Trump, you know, who know that Trump is evil and dangerous, a danger to not only our country, but to the planet. But still, they bend over backwards to, you know, to be, pardon the phrase, fair and balanced. Sometimes in their zeal to be fair, they overdo it. But for the most part, the media is what keeps us informed. That's, you know, and I'm not only talking about shows like mine. You need the New York Times, the Washington Post. Yeah, I've got my issues with them, but they're doing incredible work. And I don't know where we'd be right now without them. We'd be a lot further down that authoritarian road than we are now. Just saying. One last story for you before we break. Michael Avenatti is back in the news. Not that he's ever been too far out of the news, but he appeared on some panel in Los Angeles yesterday where he said he has three more clients who allege affairs with and payoffs by Donald Trump that happened right before the election.
Attorney Michael Avenatti unleashing new damning allegations against President Donald Trump.
There are three additional female clients of mine that have not been disclosed that were paid hush money prior to the 2016 election, whether it be from Michael Cohen on behalf of the president, an entity that Michael Cohen formed, or AMI.
At a political panel in West Hollywood late Thursday night, Avenatti also revealing in front of the crowd.
I will tell you that at least one of those women claimed to be pregnant at the time.
Whoa.
Avenatti is the outspoken attorney of Stephanie Clifford, the porn star who goes by Stormy Daniels. She says she had sex with the president while he was married, and days before the 2016 election, she was paid $130,000 to stay silent. When asked if Avenatti's mysterious other three clients also had affairs with the president.
Last time I checked, they weren't just handing out checks to anyone, whether they had a relationship or not.
And as if that wasn't enough news, Avenatti addressing rumors about a presidential run in 2020.
If I do not get a sense that the Democratic Party has the right street fighter and the right person to go up against Donald Trump in the general election, I will absolutely run and I will defeat him, period.
You know, part of me would like to see that. But Michael Avenatti, sorry, you're not the president. You're not a president. You're a good lawyer, I'm sure. I'm glad you're out there fighting the good fight. But that doesn't qualify you to be president. It really doesn't. You know, give me Elizabeth Warren. Give me Bernie Sanders. I heard something about like a Warren Sherrod Brown ticket. You know, that would work. I want somebody who understands, who has worked in government and who understands how it works. Call me crazy. Okay. All right. Coming up, as I told you, we have author and political scientist David Ferris coming on the show today. He's got a new book out called It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. We'll get him on after we hear from Brad and Desi in the Green News Report.
These images look like Dante's Inferno.
Extreme weather brings a hot and deadly July to most of the planet.
Yosemite National Park will be closing today due to dangerous conditions.
Wildfires force evacuations in the U.S. West.
Get this, they got a month of rain in mere days.
While extreme storms and floods pummel the East. Plus,
the Trump administration this week is expected to open a new front in America's environmental battle.
Trump and the GOP expand their war on the environment.
All of those battles and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
This is really about rewarding the largest corporate polluters.
Of course, they're not just going to pollute for free, you know. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, we look away for just a few days, and man, it's like the entire planet
is on fire.
Yeah, extreme weather has brought a hot and deadly July to much of the planet. Greece has declared a state of emergency after intense heat and wind-driven wildfires killed more than 80 people. Outbreaks of wildfires in Europe now extend above the Arctic Circle, which is also in the midst of an unprecedented heat wave. Northern Finland this week hit an all-time high temperature record of 94 degrees. This is above the Arctic Circle. The BBC reports that elsewhere in Europe, farmers are declaring bankruptcy because of crop failures due to persistent drought and heat. Japan also hit an all-time high heat record, 106 degrees Fahrenheit, amid a weeks-long extreme heat wave that has killed at least 70 people and sent 22,000 people to hospitals. Just weeks after record rains triggered deadly flash floods and landslides that also killed hundreds.
Now, to be clear, of course, it's summer, so we expect the weather to be warm, but these are record warm temperatures all across the globe.
And not just record warm temperatures, record extreme rain events. These are in line with what climate scientists have projected we will see thanks to man-made global warming.
Well, we are seeing it.
Yep. And in California, officials have ordered evacuations and partial closure of Yosemite National Park at the height of the tourism season due to the fast-moving Ferguson fire. Smoke from that fire has also made air quality in the park worse than notoriously polluted Beijing, China. On the East Coast, 30 million people are facing flash flood warnings from extreme rainfall events, with Pennsylvania in particular grappling with historic flooding. Meanwhile, in politics, leaked documents show that the Trump administration intends to strip key provisions from the Endangered Species Act to cripple the nearly 50-year-old law that has saved iconic American wildlife like the grizzly bear and the bald eagle and more than 200 other animals from extinction. Biologists say gutting the Endangered Species Act will harm healthy and productive ecosystems, but according to Brett Hartle of the Center for Biological Diversity in an interview on Fox News, the administration's goal is really just to benefit industry.
It will probably, over time and collectively, degrade many of the natural areas that are part of America's heritage. This is really about rewarding the largest corporate polluters.
That was on Fox News?
Yes, it was.
How'd that happen?
Republicans in Congress are also working on legislation to eliminate protections for wildlife. The Sierra Club called the coordinated assault, quote, essentially a death sentence to some of our most imperiled wildlife. Former Congressman John Dingell of Michigan, one of the original authors of the Endangered Species Act, told National Geographic it would not pass Congress with today's anti-science Republican majority. He said, quote, I don't think I could pass the Lord's Prayer in that nuthouse.
Love John Dingell.
The Trump administration also plans to try to revoke the state of California's special authority under the Clean Air Act to set its own tougher emission standards for vehicles to reduce its air pollution. That's a move expected to launch a lengthy court battle that very likely could reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
And because Republicans believe so much in states' rights that they want to keep California from having the right to determine their own environmental regulations.
Thousands of pages of internal emails accidentally released and then retracted by the Interior Department show that, contrary to his public statements, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and his aides dismissed archaeological discoveries and evidence showing that the economic benefits of tourism bring billions of dollars in revenue to rural economies. They used that to justify shrinking national monuments for the benefit of mining, logging, ranching, and drilling interests. It bears pointing out that once lost, Americans' public lands and animals are gone for good. Finally, the Trump administration has ended a requirement that industries must pay when their operations cause damage to the public's lands, meaning drillers, miners, and land developers will no longer be required to pay to repair any damages that they cause to wildlife and habitats on public lands.
Of course they won't. For much more on all of these stories and the many we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
Ooh.
can't afford a monthly donation? Is that what's getting you down, Bunky? But maybe you shop on Amazon.com occasionally?
Well then, just use the NicoleSandler.com Amazon portal, and we'll get a small commission on all your purchases.
But I just bought...
Don't worry, we can't see what you bought.
Just bookmark Amazon through the NicoleSandler.com portal, and use it. Every purchase helps Nicole stay on the air.
And now, back to Nicole on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
All right, let's get our guest on the line. David Ferris is an associate professor of political science at Roosevelt University in Chicago, a contributing writer at The Week, and author of the new book, It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. David, are you there?
I'm here, yeah. Thanks for having me on the show, Nicole.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. Actually, I learned about you from a listener who said, there's this new book you need to read and get the author on. And here we are. So the book is it's Time to Fight Dirty. I couldn't agree with you more. Democrats don't play dirty the way Republicans do, do they? They just seem to not have that that long view, the big picture view, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's always been sort of a more of a sort of pragmatic compromising instinct inside of the Democratic Party. Which maybe made sense a few decades ago, but over the last 25 years, I think has become increasingly incompatible with the style of our politics, which is, you see the Republican Party sort of pressing their advantage procedurally at every chance that they have, sort of pursuing maximalist policies, but also really pressing the boundaries of constitutional legality in terms of things like, suppressing voters and holding up Supreme Court appointments, things like that. So I think the Democrats have been really slow to recognize that change in American politics. But I think we're starting to see that change a bit. But I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, I think the party overall is less eager for the kind of partisan combat that I think is inevitable at this point.
Yeah, I think they want to, they want to appear to be like the adults in the room, which in many cases they are when you compare them to the people across the aisle. But the Republicans, again, they play the long game. And right now they seem to have won. They control all three branches of government, and they're sinking their tentacles into the Supreme Court for decades to come. So the question is, and I think I know what your answer is going to be, because you got a book about it, is it too late to get the power back?
No, I mean, I think, we still live in a kind of a democracy. I think it's degraded a bit over the past 20 years. But I do think that we'll have a real chance to win in 2018 and 2020. We're fighting at a disadvantage, as we always are, in national elections because of, the way the structure of how we elect the House of Representatives is tilted against us, the way the Senate is tilted against us. And so I feel like we have this really unique opportunity over the next two cycles to take advantage of this incredibly toxic and unpopular president and the sort of the handmaidens in his party and ride that dissatisfaction back into power. And so it's really what we do if and when we get back into power that's the subject of this book, because I think it's really important to address some of the structural deficits that lead everyone to say, we have to win the House election by 7 points in order to win the House. And it's like, well, that's crazy.
Right. Well, we know that
in
recent elections, I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I know that I believe in most of the recent elections, the Democrats actually got more votes for their candidates in the House of Representatives than the Republicans did, but the Republicans won, and that's a function of gerrymandering, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't happen too often in terms of Democrats winning the vote for the House, but that did happen in 2012 when Democrats won the national House vote by more than a million votes, but they still had this huge deficit in the House. In other years, it's just been Republicans winning more seats than they should have won according to the popular vote. So Republicans won the House vote by about a point in 2016, but they have this enormous majority that allows them to pursue these deeply unpopular policies like the tax cut that I don't think would have gotten through you know, even if you leave the 2016 election results alone as they were, and you have a fair system for the House, I don't think that they would have had a big enough majority to pursue some of the things that they've done over the past year. So it's an example of why it's really important for Democrats the next time they're in power to address some of these structural problems in the political system, rather than assuming that our policies are going to be so awesome
right.
that we'll just get elected over and over again. You know?
Right. So, is there a way? I mean, you're saying we got to wait until the Democrats take back control and then fix the problems. Is there a way to fix the problem so that the Democrats? Well, I mean, they need to come out in such great numbers. What did you say? By 7%, they need to win in order to overcome the disadvantages, the gerrymandering, the voter caging, the voter suppression, all that's you know, keeping the numbers
down.
Yeah,
I mean, there's some disagreement among people who study these things. There's some people that think we could win the House by winning the House vote by as few as 4 points. I've read a couple of people that think it needs to be like 11, mm-hmm. which is impossible.
Right.
You know, so for this cycle in 2018, I mean, we really have no choice but to fight according to the unfair rules that we have. And then we're going to have to do it again in 2020 because, you know, it's not like Donald Trump's going to sign a law reforming House
nope.
voting or making D.C. and Puerto Rico states for the Senate. He's just not going to do that. So it's really, it's depressing. It's a depressing answer to your question, but we have to, like, survive the next, you know, 2.5 years and just win when we're down. Like, we're starting the game down a touchdown, but we got to win it anyway.
Right.
And then we got to make sure that we don't have to fight like that anymore, you know.
Well, in order to make these changes, the Democrats really need to take back control of both houses of Congress and the White House. But then we have the problem of the Supreme Court, which right now, with what Trump is trying to do, it's going to be a very right, very conservative Supreme Court for decades to come. How do we counter that?
Well, I think the Supreme Court is another area where we don't just have to sit back and let the political system kind of screw us over. You know, I mean, I think that there's things that we can do, things that I don't think that many of us would consider if Republicans hadn't kind of stolen the swing seat on the Supreme Court by refusing to appoint Merrick Garland in 2016. But because they did that, which was a perfectly legal constitutional thing to do, but just was a violation of longstanding expectation, I think that gives Democrats the right to consider adding seats to the court the next time they're in power. Because you're right, this is going to be the first real hard right majority on the Supreme Court since the 1930s. And the kinds of things that court might do are really terrifying. And more importantly than that, I mean, I think even if we do get back into power and, you know, the presidential candidate of your choice, the leader of the progressive wing, whoever it is in mm-hmm. 2020, they could pass Medicare for All, and it could get swatted down
That's
by the
right.
Supreme Court.
That's right.
You know, and so we have to think. We have to think a little bit more radically. I mean, the number of judges on the court is not in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Constitution has very little to say about the Supreme Court at all. It's a very brief document. It's particularly brief on the powers of the court. But one thing that's very clear is that Congress has the right to change the number of justices on the Supreme Court. And to me, I really just don't see the difference between, you know, using a legal constitutional maneuver to hold a seat open and then using a legal constitutional maneuver to add judges and to restore the liberal majority that was really stolen from us in 2016.
That's right. This comes under the heading of fighting dirty, right? Mitch McConnell keeping
exactly.
that seat open
yeah.
for almost a year. That was fighting dirty. Yes, they legally were able to do it. And one thing a lot of people don't remember is, you know, they were all sure that Hillary Clinton was going to win. We were all pretty convinced of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about it was public pronouncements. They were talking about keeping that seat open for her entire 4 years, not letting whoever her pick to fill that seat was to get confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, those were not fringe figures only
no.
talking about that. That was Richard Burr. That was John McCain.
That's
said something
right.
like that.
That's
know?
Right.
And I think if you could get, they got the entire Republican caucus to hold out the Merrick Garland nomination. I mean, it's inconceivable to me that they wouldn't be able to do the same to block Hillary Clinton's pick for the entire 4 years of her term. I think you can do a little another little thought experiment like this. Like, what if they had appointed Garland and then the 2016 elections had gone the same as they did? I think it's Republicans that would be packing the court right now. Right. So,
interesting.
You know, I think these things are coming. They're coming at us. And I think we have to get ahead of them. Just, I think one of the big problems that we've seen from Democrats over the last 20 years is we sort of engage in this reactive politics when Republicans violate these norms and expectations, or they manipulate rules in ways that benefit them and very kind of deliberately disadvantage our coalition. Like in the realm of voting rights, we're left, you know, taking things to the courts rather than, you know, doing something proactive with the power that we have when we have it.
So we talked about the House of Representatives for a few minutes. And so You're saying that we need to change how we elect the House and increase the size of the House? Is that one of the things you're proposing?
Yeah, that's the idea. So the most important piece of this reform would be, instead of having 435 separate elections and separate districts in the House, we would have larger districts, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 member districts, if I had my way. So that when you walk into the voting booth, you would rank the candidates. So it's called ranked choice voting.
Right.
And so you'd be electing multiple people out of a large district. And that would do a few really cool things. It would make the outcome, make the results more proportional for the parties, you know, reflecting their votes. And it would also eliminate gerrymandering from the face of the earth. Like, you would not be able to gerrymander this new House of Representatives. And the bigger the districts are under this system, this is how Ireland elects their parliament. The bigger the districts are, the more proportional the results. So, there's a number of reasons to increase the size of the House. It helps make this reform work, but it also, I think, would actually bring the House more in line with what the architects of the Constitution envisioned. They thought there should be no more than 30,000 constituents for every member of the House.
Wow.
And we now have 700,000.
Wow. So,
you know, to bring it strictly in line with their vision, we'd need a 10,000 person House, and I don't think that would work. But
no.
I do think 870 is a completely reasonable number to sort of increase the responsiveness of the government. It'd make it harder for dark money to influence any individual race, because there'd be so many races and they'd all be competitive. So it's just, I mean, I could talk for 10 minutes about how great this reform would be. It's a little bit complicated, you know, and it'd require a lot of voter education, but I do think it's something Democrats really need to consider the next time they're in there. And a bill has been introduced in the House to do this.
Really? It has been introduced recently?
Yeah, I mean, it's introduced by a Democrat, you know, so it's Senator Don Beyer from Virginia. So it's not going anywhere.
Uh-huh.
Because Paul Ryan is not going to consider this.
Of course not.
And it would require Democrats, I think, to accept the presence of third and fourth parties in Congress, too, because that's another outcome of proportional representation voting, is that it invites third and fourth parties into the process. So,
which wouldn't be a bad thing.
No, of course. I mean, I think, you know, overwhelming majorities of Americans have always said that they want more than two choices when they go to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sympathetic to that, but I think it's not going to work unless we change the system to make it possible for third parties to win. Otherwise, you're just going to split the votes of your coalition, you know.
Right.
So I think, you know, I could see a Democratic Party having to share power with a Green Party or a Working Families Party in Congress. And I think that would be great, you know.
That's part of the problem right now. And I know a number of my listeners are fed up with the Democratic Party, and I am too. However, right now we are in a catastrophic emergency. I mean, we've got to get Trump's power checked, and the only way to do that at this point, I think, is to elect Democrats, to get Democrats back in control of the House and hopefully the Senate as well, put a check on his power so he can stop destroying everything good that we have in place. But in terms of reforming the Democratic Party, we've got a real problem with the party. Our leadership is ancient, and it's not about their physical age. It's about the attitudes. One of the problems we have is that the DCCC keeps putting up, supporting the most conservative of the Democratic candidates and actively, in some cases, working against the progressive candidates.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we've seen repeatedly over the last few years. You know, I think the most recent case was the Texas primary with Laura Moser.
And, that's right.
I think the DCC has gotten DCCC DCCC we'll mm-hmm. go with that has gotten involved in races that it doesn't need to get involved in. You know,
stay out of primaries.
I think it's like you want to weigh in on a race like that if you really think that one of the people is. You know, like we have like three Nazis that slipped through Republican primaries, you know, like
Yeah. There
is a place where you want the National Party to put its finger on the scale. Not in races where, you know, you have two good Democratic candidates and one of them happens to be more progressive than the other. That's just going to make, it's going to make the activists angry. It's going to sort of raise, bad memories of 2016 and, mm-hmm. and give people the impression that the party is siding with a certain faction when it's supposed to be a big tent, right?
So that's right.
We really don't want to see that. And I think in a broader sense, I think the party's been really slow to respond to this new environment. Like when I hear Chuck Schumer talk about what's going on in the world right now, he just doesn't seem alarmed enough to me, you know?
No.
Like when he promised Mitch McConnell that he wouldn't abolish the filibuster if Democrats take back the Senate, it's like, no.
Right.
No, this is not the world that we live in anymore. Like if Democrats want to get anything done next time they're in power, they have to eliminate the filibuster. Because we're not getting to 60 seats in a Senate that's tilted against us, like hopelessly, you know?
Right.
We'll be lucky if we get back into power.
Well,
so.
The Democrats, when they were in power, they abolished the filibuster for a lot of cabinet-level appointments, everything but the Supreme Court. So the Republicans get in power. The first thing they do is they abolish the filibuster for the Supreme Court. So now you only need 51 votes instead of 60.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the Democrats try to play with honor, whatever that is in this day and age, and the Republicans fight dirty. That's why I guess the title of your book is It's Time to Fight Dirty.
And it's really, we think of it as fighting dirty, but we could also just think of it as like, you know, fighting on equal footing with mm-hmm. your opponents. I mean, go back to 2009 and imagine what we might have accomplished had we eliminated the filibuster in the Senate in 2009 and 2010.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only I think could we have had the public option for the ACA, I think we could have had a better ACA, like beyond that.
Without a doubt.
We could have had tougher financial regulations. We could have had a bigger stimulus. We could have shown working people who were struggling in that time period that we have better legislative answers, but instead we kind of stuck to this tradition, this filibuster tradition, which is like, when you think about it, I'm sorry, it's absurd. There's no other Democratic legislature on the face of the earth that requires 60 votes to pass routine legislation. And that's just as true right now as it was when we were in power. I mean, the filibuster is stopping some bad things from happening right now, but I don't believe in it as a democratic institution. I think it's anti-democratic. And if it has to be us that does away with it, then, you know.
Well, I hope it's not them who do away with it, because, again, the things that they're proposing, the things that the filibuster is stopping are
right.
You know, it's life and death here. There's so much more damage they can do while they have power, of, you know, of all three branches.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think one thing that's stopping them is they only have 51 votes in the Senate. Really 50 because McCain's out right now.
Right.
And so I don't think they have the votes to do it with filibuster, but you know, if things go, I'm trying to be optimistic, but if things go horribly wrong and we lose seats in the Senate and Republicans have like 55, 56 seats next year, I think that they will, you know, I think that they would do away with it. So
Wow. To
me, it's only a matter of time before this rule goes away, because the rule is not compatible with the shape of our politics right now, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, it's become sharply ideological, like sharply partisan. Democrats are behind in that project, but they're catching up. And so somebody's going to do it. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody's going to do away with this rule.
Yep. And Trump has been calling for it. Mitch McConnell has been the one saying, no, we're not going to do away with it. I hope he holds to that. I don't trust Mitch McConnell for a moment. But let's talk about the Senate for a second here, David, because, you know, we're talked about the House of Representatives and how that's broken. The Senate is pretty broken, too. It's a big problem where two senators represent every state from the most populous, California, to, I don't know, the least populous, Wyoming or Montana. The fact that every state has the same two representatives, regardless of how many people they're representing in each state. That's undemocratic, isn't it?
It's absurd. I mean, the Senate is like an absurd institution. I would burn it down tomorrow morning if I could. But the problem is, not literally,
of course.
It's a nice building. Mm-hmm. But I would get rid of it. The problem is that it's sort of embedded in the Constitution in a way that is very, very difficult, if not impossible, to change, because the Constitution says that states can't be deprived of their equal representation in the Senate without the consent, which means we can't even amend the Constitution to do this. Like, we're really stuck with it. And so at the moment, we have 30 or 31 Republican-leaning states and, 20 or 21 Democratic-leaning states. Maybe it's 29, 22, if we're, like, optimistic about a couple of states that may be trending in our direction. But the reality is that makes it a structural deficit. Like, in a neutral environment, Republicans would control, between 55 and 60 seats, and we would control between 40 and 45. And so as I was, like, lying awake at night, with insomnia and terror and, mm-hmm. and misery after the election, I was thinking,
you weren't alone. Yes.
My God, what can we do about this? I think the answer is more states, more Democratic-leaning states.
And
the sort of the low-hanging fruit is statehood for Washington, D.C. and mm-hmm. statehood for Puerto Rico.
Right.
That probably almost certainly gives us 4 extra seats in the Senate. We'd have the Senate right now if we had done that 10 years ago. And more seats in the House, too, and more electoral votes. So it makes the electoral math better for us, too. And if that's not enough, then I think that we should consider breaking up a state like California into 7 pieces. And all of these things are perfectly constitutional, perfectly legal maneuvers. That would finally, I think, bring us parity in the Senate, at least, right? This is it's like we're playing hardball, and the hardball would get us back to, it'd get us to a fair fight, right?
Right, but the Democrats would need to be in control of everything before that could happen.
Sure, yeah. I mean, D.C. voted in a referendum for statehood mm-hmm. in 2016, overwhelmingly, like a vast supermajority. And the Republican Congress just is refusing to act on that, and President Trump, of course, would not sign the bill, because they know it would hurt them in a partisan sense, even
right.
though it's obviously the right thing to do. It's like 700,000 people in D.C. have no voting representation in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2.6 million people in Puerto Rico, these are all American citizens who have no voting representation in Congress. And particularly with Puerto Rico, I think you see the consequences of what happens when people are not accountable to anyone. And there's no one to answer for what was done to Puerto Rico last year. So, this is the right thing to do. It's also a big win. It would be a big win for the Democratic Party. So, I hate to return to this idea that this is all part of an elaborate fantasy of us winning total power in 2020. But this is what I think that we need to be prepared to do, so that we don't just give power right back in 2022 like we did last time.
Well, but then you need real progressives in the Democratic Party to be the ones taking the lead. You need them to have leadership positions in both the House and Senate. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer ain't going to do it. And, somebody like Hillary Clinton would not be the president to do this either. So we have still have this sort of civil war going on in the Democratic Party, where you've got the centrists and the progressives not working together. How do we get the old guard to accept some of the new blood and new energy?
Well, I mean, I think it's less something that can be forced at any given moment, and more part of a gradual change that I think we're seeing in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue I think that the progressive left is winning a lot of policy fights right now.
Yeah.
If you had come to me 10 years ago and said, it's now a requirement to be a national figure in the Democratic Party to be for Medicare for all, for abolishing ICE, for a legal, path to citizenship for all undocumented immigrants. Those were controversial positions in the Democratic Party 10 years ago. Not just controversial, but I mean, a couple of those things. You probably didn't even have majority support within the party.
Right.
Whereas now it's like, if you got up and you said, I don't believe in a path to citizenship, or I don't believe in the Dreamers, you're not even a Democrat. Right? So it's like the activists have successfully moved the political center of gravity in this country such that I think it's inevitable that the next time we have a leadership election, or the next time we have a leadership changeover, I think that you'll see the energy on the progressive side. Pelosi can be deposed at any time in the House. Schumer, I think, is a little more secure in his power, but I think that if we take back the Senate in this year or in 2020, we're going to be taking back the Senate with a lot of new Democrats, a lot of younger Democrats. And I think that there will eventually be a moment where Schumer either gets out of the way or realizes that he has to do some of these things if he wants to accomplish anything. Because if they go back in there with this sort of like, let's bring the norms back from the dead politics in 2021, like they're going to be able to pass the legislation, and then they'll get kicked out. So one way or another, I'm optimistic that there's a long-term changeover in the party that's happening right now. People like, Ocasio-Cortez and these other young progressive candidates, they're not winning every primary, but they're not losing every primary.
Right.
I think they're winning the messaging fight, and they're winning the policy fight, which actually is, I think, even just as important as winning those individual primaries.
Yeah, I hear you. David Ferris is with us. His book is It's Time to Fight Dirty. How about fixing our voting system, getting away from electronic machines and back to, something revolutionary like paper ballots hand counted?
Yeah, there's a lot of problems with our voting system. Definitely. I mean, I'm sure you saw the news this week of this group that hacked one of the voting machines like so easily.
Yep. Oh, this has been going on for years. This has been happening.
And so, has that affected outcomes? I don't know, but I'm not real comfortable having to wonder. We'd all have to get used to, election night being like election week.
Yes. Okay.
So it's like, they wouldn't be making the calls at 9 p.m. on election night anymore, but I think it's worth it to have just structural faith in these elections. But beyond that, I mean, Republicans have spent the last 20 years doing all sorts of things that undermine democracy in this country. The voter ID laws that are aimed at Democrats and minorities and marginal folks who move all the time, assaults on the voting rights of college students, voter felony disenfranchisement laws. There's over a million people in your state of Florida who don't have the right to vote because they're former felons.
That's right.
And so you see how close the election has been in Florida over the last 20 years. It's just mind-boggling to me that we haven't addressed this at a national level. So I think it's really important as one of the first matters of business next time Democrats are in power to pass a National Voting Rights Act that's not just aimed at the South, it's aimed at the whole country.
Right.
To make these voter ID laws illegal, to demand that states implement automatic voter registration, the national election holiday to drive turnout up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just, with a simple piece of national legislation, you can re-enfranchise every former felon in the country. So, or even you could pass a law saying you're not allowed to disenfranchise anyone, even if they do commit a crime. I mean, it depends on how radical you want to get with this stuff. But if you do all of these things, collectively, you're adding millions and millions of votes to the Democratic side. Because these voter ID laws and the felony disenfranchisement laws, like scholars who have studied these things, believe that they have flipped, these laws have caused Democrats to lose well over a dozen Senate races over the last 20 years. I think that they deeply influenced the 2016 election, obviously the 2000 election, right? So this is what I mean when I say we have to think about the structural barriers to progressive power. Our electoral rules lead fewer Democratic-leaning citizens to turn out to vote. Right? And if we change those laws, we make it easier for people to vote. It's not like everyone will turn out, but more people will turn out.
Mm-hmm.
If we give them more parties to vote for, then I think even more people will turn out. Right? So all these reforms are linked together in ways that would reinforce progressive power, that would get more voters to the polls, that would increase the legitimacy of our elections, and I think would lead to make it possible to stay in power for more than 2 years.
Right.
So that we can pass some real progressive reforms and sort of change the trajectory of the society.
Can we also get rid of the Electoral College?
Oh, yeah, well, that's a tricky one. It's another one. I don't write about that much in the book because it is in the Constitution. I mean, there's a movement to pass something called the National Popular Vote Compact, Interstate Popular Vote Compact. And that's so states pass a law that says if states totaling 270 electoral votes pass this law, all of those states will agree to give their electoral votes to the popular vote winner rather than the Electoral College winner.
I like that.
It's pretty cool. And it's just the problem is it's not clear what would happen to that law in the courts.
especially with the Republicans controlling the courts. David Ferris, we're just about out of time. Thank you so much.
Sure.
It's a fascinating topic. The Democrats need to, you know, toughen up. And I love the title. It is time to fight dirty. How Democrats can build a lasting majority in American politics. David Ferris. You can find him on Twitter at David M. Ferris. And I'll put a link to the book on the blog at NicoleSandler.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate the conversation.
Yeah, me too. I had a great time. Thanks, Nicole.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And thank you. We're done for the day and the week. Have a wonderful weekend. And I'll be back again Tuesday. No hospital stay for me coming up this time, okay? All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you Tuesday.